Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The sexual abuse of children in our highly sexualized society is one of the deepest scars on the face of our culture. Tragically, children have not been safe in any of the churches, including the Catholic Church, and although the extent of sexual abuse is often misreported or exaggerated, the fact that it happens at all is completely and totally unacceptable. The way in which the Catholic Church has been dealing with sexual abuse and the sexual abusers has been underwhelming and again contributed to the problem. One of the priests who has a reputation for being most experienced in safeguarding is Father Hans Zollner. He's a German Jesuit. He has a doctorate in the University of Innsbruck and obtained a licentiate in psychology from the Institute of Psychology at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He's a licensed psychotherapist. He's regarded as one of the leading ecclesiastical experts in the field of safeguarding from sexual abuse and has been a member of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors since its creation. He recently tendered his resignation, and we hoped that he would be able to join us on the Catholic Herald podcast to give us some more profound insight into exactly what the extent of sexual abuse is and what drives it and what can be done about it, and in particular how the Catholic Church can shed its image of hiding from both the fact of the abuse and sheltering the abusers. To discuss one of the most important subjects in the Church, he joins me now. Father Zollner, thank you very much for coming to talk to us. I'm looking forward enormously to hearing what you have to say, because the whole issue of safeguarding is one of the most pressing difficulties that the Catholic Church, amongst so many other institutions, faces at the moment. But what I'd like to do, first of all, is to give you an opportunity to describe yourself, because you're primarily, as well as a Jesuit priest, you're primarily an academic, as well as and a psychologist. Could you just tell our listeners a little bit about your background and the qualifications that you have, and what experiences bring you to the present moment, the responsibilities of safeguarding you have in this conversation?
Thank you for having me, and thank you for listening. I'm a Jesuit priest from Bavaria, from Regensburg, Pope Benedict City. I grew up in a Catholic family, as well as I grew up in my home parish, in an area that used to be very Catholic, and is much less now compared to my youth. I started as a seminarian of my home diocese and then went on to Innsbruck for completing my theological degree. After that, I entered the Society of Jesus in Germany. And then, after novitiate, I was working in the chaplaincy of the Munich Public University, where I encountered for the first time sexual violence when I was accompanying students from other parts of the world who shared experiences about violence that they had gone through. However, that was something that was only a one-off, if you wish, experience. Then in 94, I started to study psychology and trained as a psychotherapist at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. And here again, when I was starting my therapeutic training, I encountered a case of sexual violence in a non-church environment and was helped greatly by my supervisor to navigate that very difficult situation for the person. And again, it was something that was not repeating itself in my therapeutic work for quite a number of years. But I was alerted to this reality and the suffering of survivors of this type of violence. And then I came back to teach at the very same institute where I had trained 6 years later, after having been chaplain in a boarding school and finished my doctorate in theology. I was called to teach and to train psychotherapists at this institute. We came to know Monsignor Stephen Rossetti, who is an American priest and psychologist, former director of the St. Luke Institute in Silver Spring, Massachusetts, who was a leading figure in the 90s and 2000s in the US, shepherding the Catholic bishops in a very serious journey, taking into account what had happened in terms of setting up the Dallas Charter and also offering treatment to offenders, perpetrators. He gave us a workshop, and in early 2004, which was very helpful and very influential for me, because from that moment on I got much interested in following news about child sexual abuse committed by clergy. That was after 2002, the Boston Spotlight case and publications, and that continued for a number of years until in 2010 the cases exploded in Germany, precisely in a Jesuit school in Berlin. So I was involved in different ways, because it was a Jesuit school, it was I had read about it, I had studied what concerns child sexual abuse, abuse in general. And so I found the reaction and church leadership in my country and in other countries very disturbing in terms of an uncoordinated response, sometimes contradicting each other, and certainly not reaching out to victims and not giving enough space for the voices of those who had been harmed, victims themselves, secondary victims, their families, their friends, the institutions, the parishes, the religious congregations that then were split. And all this led me to write on this issue, to publish articles and a little book on child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. And then things came together as I was called to the scientific working group of the federal German government's round table on child sexual abuse in Germany, where I came to know the who's who of people in the German-speaking countries who worked for many years in the area of abuse and prevention. I was appointed vice-rector of the university and dean of psychology. At the same time, our Jesuit headquarters, the Curia, approached the Gregorian with the request to organize an international conference, and I was asked to chair this organizing committee. That conference took place in 2012, and in the same moment we had established a consortium in the collaboration of the Archdiocese of Munich in Germany, a public university's medical hospital for youth in Ulm, and our Gregorian University to set up a Center for Child Protection, which was meant to provide online training for church personnel in the area of safeguarding. And a little later, it came to the establishment of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, of which I was a founding member, in March 2014. And from there on, things went uphill in terms of much more work, much more requests for conferences, workshops, studies, training, education. We continued with the blended e-learning program to this day. And in 2015, we started residential courses at the Gregorian University for safeguarding personnel within the church, in English first, and then also in Spanish. Doctorates on different issues concerning abuse and prevention. So this has brought me to many places in the world. I've been to all continents with this topic and to more than 70 countries. So alongside with the work we do with students from all over the globe at the Gregorian University, I've also gathered a lot of first-hand experience in different parts of the world where the challenges are in terms of how abuse has been perpetrated, how it has been covered up, and what can be done in terms of safeguarding.
Thank you. I've got a number of questions I'd like to ask you. They're questions that arise almost every time one has this conversation, particularly with people outside the church. I think it's fairly obvious that the impact of sexual abuse, particularly on minors, within an organization like the Catholic Church, where trust is at a higher premium than almost any other environment other than the family, perhaps. But I think the two things I'd like to ask are, how does the church as an institution compare with other institutions, including the family, in terms of child abuse? Because it's developed a reputation in the public space for being perhaps the worst offender by far. And the other question that I'd like to ask following that is the extent to which, is, if we know, and we may not have the information, the extent to which it's particularly a feature of the late 20th century and somehow relates to the sexualization of society, at least in part, rather than only the corruption of the church. Could you address both those questions?
Surely. As much as it is possible. Why it's difficult to say something substantial in regard to the two questions is that simply we don't have reliable numbers, neither for comparing the Catholic Church and Catholic clergy to other denominations and other religions, nor to historical situations beyond the 1950s or so. We have, with regard to religions, as we have seen in the Royal Commission report in Australia on sexual abuse, that the prevalence rates, as far as they could be substantiated, are pretty much the same in Buddhism, in Islam, in the Jewish religion, and maybe in other groups like Jehovah's Witnesses or the like. We have had recently in Germany the publication of a national survey on the prevalence of child sexual abuse committed by Lutheran clergy, and many people were very much surprised that it showed basically the same proportion of allegations against Protestant Lutheran mainly married pastors as with Catholic clergy, celibate clergy. So that was a big surprise to many. we have very few studies from very few countries into, for example, prevalence rates of perpetration by a non-Catholic Christian clergy. The numbers from the ICSA report in the UK are an exception in this regard. But if anybody says that the Catholic clergy is more likely to abuse children or youth sexually, this person cannot substantiate the affirmation in relationship to other denominations or religions, simply for the fact that we don't have the possibility of comparison, because there is hardly any, comparable studies out there. In relation to Catholic clergy, we have lots of studies now, again, only from maybe 25 countries, but when it comes to other religions and other denominations, there are very, very few studies that could be compared to the situation in the clergy. So simply from a scientific point of view, you cannot affirm, you cannot pretend that it is proven that Catholic clergy is particularly prone to abusive behavior of that kind. It doesn't take away the fact that it is devastating to see that between 3 to 5% of Catholic clergy has been accused of sexual abuse in some of those countries of which we have numbers. It is terrible to see that, and it is necessary to acknowledge that, but simply in terms of who is more likely to abuse, we have no reliable numbers.
I think of all the things we might have said during this conversation, what you've just expressed is probably the most important thing of all. So, I mean, first of all, thank you for emphasizing, as I'm sure everyone would expect us both to, the deep tragedy that happens at all. But having said that, one of the reasons what you said is so important is because there are issues of causation and correlation that people confuse. But essentially, the whole phenomena has been used as an attempt to attack the discipline of celibacy or the Catholic Church itself. And and as you quite rightly say, improperly. I think people would be very surprised that the numbers of those accused are as low as 3 to 5%. Lamentable that that is. But I was going to ask you too, if we don't have figures for other religions, we do have figures for other institutions, secular institutions. It's my understanding, for example, that incidences of child abuse in youth organizations, like we have the Boy Scouts in England and in America, in schools, of course, and within family situations, above all, incidents of abuse, I think, are higher than any other organization. Once again, I only say this not to defend the Catholic Church, but in order to invite you to give us the statistics of comparison between what happens in the Catholic Church and in other secular organizations. Can you offer some figures?
Yeah, again, I can offer figures for different sectors of society. I would refrain from comparing numbers, for example, for sports trainers, public school teachers, or music teachers, simply because if you want to compare, you would have to do a very complicated math, in the sense of you have the overall population, you have the overall number of hours that people spend with youth, you have to, and then you have to gauge the gravity of the abusive behavior, the type, and so forth. So it's very difficult to compare one professional group to another. However, every expert who has worked in this field of abuse and safeguarding knows that by far the biggest number of abuse cases is coming from the context of family. Now, I say context of family because it does not necessarily mean only the nuclear family, the core family. It includes also uncles and grandfathers and the like. We know that from all statistics we have that the most the people who carry the biggest risk of abusive behavior are stepfathers and are elder brothers to their sisters. So these are the two groups of people within the family context that carry the highest risk of abusive behavior. There are the overall difficulty with numbers in our field is that most abuse will never be known. There are two German words that are used also in scientific literature to identify the known numbers and the unknown numbers. And the known numbers are called the numbers in the Hellfeld, so in the light field, in the light of the sun. So all what we know by allegations, by testimonies, by casework in police and so forth. By far, the bigger number is what is in the dark. So the Dunkelfeld, what is in the dark field, is probably 10 times more than the known cases. This is the overall assumption in the scientific world, that for one case we know about, 9 to 10 more cases are not known and will never be known. Why? Because of shame, because of difficulties to address it, because of whatever considerations and whatever difficulties victims of abuse or people who could know about find to speak out about the abuse. So this is a very important fact that society at large needs to face a much bigger, let me say, crisis, if you wish, that society does not acknowledge and has never acknowledged, that there are, as far as the World Health Organization says, in every single country in this world, every fifth girl, so 20% of all girls in any society, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, in the Americas, in Oceania, every fifth girl suffers sexual harassment or assault or abuse before the age of 18. And every eighth or tenth boy suffers sexual assault before the age of 18, which, if you think about that, these are huge numbers. We talk about millions or hundreds of millions of young people in this world who have suffered and are suffering sexual abuse. And society at large is not willing to address that. You don't find politicians, you don't find many associations, political parties that really combat this evil in the midst of society.
I have so many questions that emerge from this. I mean, that's an enormous figure. And again, thank you very much, because people are not going to hear that except from an expert like you, because, as you say, it's politically or sociologically unacceptable. But the questions I'd like to ask, please, are the breakdown between heterosexual and homosexual abuse, and again, whether it's different within the church, inevitably in the Catholic Church with celibacy, that might slant the statistics, although whether it tells us anything endemically true, I'm not sure we could know. But just for the sake of statistics, first of all, do the secular figures you've just quoted about child abuse for girls and boys, do they replicate statistically within the Catholic Church? And do you have a view as a professional about the predatoriness of either homosexual, heterosexual, or bisexual? Obviously men, because it's men predominantly who are doing this. So clearly not exclusively, but predominantly.
So let me start with the letter. As far as we know, there is no distinction when it comes to the prevalence of predatory behavior among hetero or homosexual or bisexual people, or whatever orientation one would claim. It is, in all probability, again, we won't have ever the real numbers. We have some estimate about this. So the percentage of those among heterosexuals and among homosexuals who abuse minors, in all probability, is very, very close to each other. Secondly, the general society, in all probability, much more abuse, sexual abuse against minors, is committed against girls as compared to boys. The numbers seem to change also for that, not only because society is changing, but also because in all probability, sexually abused boys did not report, or better, reported even less than girls, because of the enormous shame that many of the boys experienced. So we have to reckon with a higher number, an unknown higher number of abuse against boys in society at large.
Can I just ask you, before you go on, just for the sake of clarification, obviously what you say is correct. Does this take into account the weighting of the fact that 98% of abusers are going to be heterosexual, because the split between heterosexual and homosexual is generally, at least until the last 5 years, taken to be about 98% to 2%? I mean, that obviously there are going to be variations, but that is what you've described. Does that take that into account, or are we simply assessing numbers?
No, so there are two factors here. One is I was referring to the prevalence of perpetration by hetero and homosexuals, and in all probability, sure, there is a very similar number in proportion of heterosexuals and homosexuals who
that's the question I was asking. Yes. Thank you. That's very helpful. Great.
However, the second factor is that sexuality and sexual orientation are, let me say, are much more complex than black and white. There is development of sexual orientation, which is recognized also in church documents. When you look into, for example, the document of the admission of homosexuals to the seminary and the priesthood, where in that document, which has been taken up also in the guidelines for priestly formation recently, in 2016, It acknowledges that people who went through a homosexual period or phase in their adolescence can change or can come to a heterosexual orientation later in their lives. But what I want to say is here something that has been spelled out by the John Jay report as early as 2004. It has been repeated in 2010, and many other studies have proven that there is certainly a much higher percentage of homosexual abuse committed by male Catholic clergy than in society at large, where the bigger proportion of victims of abuse are girls. So how do we explain that? One, in all probability, there is a higher percentage of homosexual clergy than homosexual persons in male persons in the general society. So there is a higher percent in all probability. Again, we don't have, for understandable reasons, we don't have exact numbers for that. But there is a, in all probability, there is a higher number of homosexual priests in Catholic clergy. That does not mean, secondly, that it is only those who identify as homosexuals who abuse boys. In the John Jay report, this fact that either heterosexual or bisexual or people who have no clear sexual identity abuse boys has caused abuse of boys for the opportunities that had been created, especially before 1982, by the fact that priests were basically dealing with minors of age, mainly or prevalently with boys. There were no female altar servers. There were very few mixed schools run by male clergy or religious. There were mainly youth activities with boys. So that is why in the reports that is called the opportunist abusive situation, which does not take away that the fact that does not immediately or that it is a clear indication that the person who is abused is identifying himself as an homosexual. Mm-hmm. We see this also since 1982 when altar servers were female altar servers were allowed. From that moment on, the numbers have changed.
Again, that's quite extraordinary. I think it'll be a great surprise to people with an ideological axe to grind to discover that that opportunism is one of the major factors. Let me take you, if I can, to the whole issue of covering up, because, again, the church is no different from every other organization. Going back to the Watergate tapes, covering up has always caused more problems than the original offense. One would have hoped, of course, that within a church, a willingness to acknowledge failure, to repent, to seek some kind of metanoia would be more normative, but that may be over ambitious. Why, particularly given the importance of having clean hands, so to speak, in society, why has it been so difficult for dioceses, for senior prelates, to foster a climate of repentance and disclosure rather than this enormously inept attempt to hide away? Obviously, it's complicated by a degree of continuing pastoral responsibility for the perpetrators as well as for the victims. I mean, you might want to say something about that. But even so, the degree of failure to acknowledge what's been going on and to deal with it is tragic, isn't it?
It is beyond tragic. It is, and it is not understandable, neither from a canonical point of view nor from a moral or spiritual point of view. It is really a failure of leadership, and we see this in liberal and in conservative dioceses and with right-wing and left-wing bishops. We see this in congregations that are known to be quite conservative as well as in liberal orders and congregations. It is something that you simply can't understand from the point of view of Christian care for the vulnerable and for those who have been hurt. It is simply mind-boggling how bishops and provincials and generals could continue for decades, we must probably say for centuries, not really listening to victims and not even applying canon law, let alone civil restrictions and norms, and let alone a moral and a spiritual closeness to those who were seeking solace, who were seeking justice, and who were seeking accompaniment. So many victims have lost their faith, not only in the church or its leadership, but also in God. And I know personally a lot of victims of child sexual abuse by clergy who were considering to train as religious or as priests, and some of them have left not only the church, but also the faith in God. And so this is really devastating. Why? I mean, as I say, from a rational, from a reflected point of view, you can't explain it easily, because there's a lot of different factors in it. It is fear, it is fear of scandal, it is fear of losing reputation, it is a closed shop mentality. We need to defend our church. We can't admit that we have failed. We have sinned. We have committed crimes. It is an alliance and allegiance with one's buddies, with the people with whom one has trained, has known, studied, worked, and so forth. It is really also very difficult to see and to learn that bishops were very clear even 50 years back or 60 or 70 years back in sending out lay people who had been accused of abuse, like sacristans or teachers in schools or the gardener who had abused minors. At that time, it was very clear that this is a very egregious crime, but not with priests and religious. They were protected and they were somehow pardoned too easily without administering the same type of justice that was applied to lay people. And of course, the image of the priest, the wish to believe that the priest would better himself and would and the promises can be believed that he would never do it again, that all calls for an analysis that takes into account all these factors. Fact is, as we have seen, the church leadership has really done a very deep disservice to the message of Christ and the message of the church, because people may forgive a perpetrator and may see that, yes, people are, committing sins and crimes. What they don't pardon anymore is to see that church leadership has been so negligent in terms of addressing the issue with the perpetrators, reaching out to the victims and their families and doing what they could to better the situation.
I mean, thank you for being so clear about that. And I think your very clarity will come as a relief to some people who are in danger of losing complete trust in an institution that is unwilling to hold perpetrators, but also unwilling to hold those who cover up for perpetrators to account. Inevitably, partly out of human interest, I must ask you about the case of Father Rupnik. The details are sort of stretch the imagination in their scandalousness. How is it possible, given the publicity and the nature of this particular kind of abuse, that he still hasn't been held to account by the institution?
Yeah, I cannot explain that. I don't know what the details of the case have been from the beginning. I am a Jesuit, and Rupnik is living, I believe, still in Rome, but I have never had any dealings with him, nor was I involved in any of the proceedings against him in terms of canonical measures. Last week or 2 weeks back, the head of the disciplinary section of the Dicastery for Doctrine, in a public appearance, stated that the canonical proceeding has advanced very much, and that in timeline, but I think it he mentioned something we will see soon, we will hear soon about the conclusion of the investigation and the verdict. So this is what all of us are waiting for, because that will hopefully bring not only clarity about the allegations against him, but also about the implications for him and all those who had been involved in the case from early stages on.
Father, thank you for saying that. We're running out of time, sadly, because we could continue this conversation for a long time. Can I ask you, you've been involved with this for a good deal of your adult life, and inevitably that must have had a very powerful impact on you as well. One can tell that it does from the words that you choose to use and your tone of voice, quite rightly. But as you reflect on this phenomenon in the church and in society, when you sit back at night, what has most impacted you? What's most surprised you? What as you come out of decades as a therapist and as a theologian and as a priest, what do you find yourself saying to yourself about the whole phenomenon?
Yeah, I have had dark moments, especially when I was confronted with the resistance within the church institutions, different levels, leaders who are denying the reality in the face of the reality, which is, I mean, it's just unimaginable how you can say, like in a country like Italy, that this is not happening here, and we don't have cases. This is an American, this is a Western European problem, despite the fact that all of us know that there are cases happening here, and not a few only. So this is really something with which I'm struggling. Why the church? Now, we could argue, who is the church? But it's not only the church leaders, it's also lay people who don't like to talk about this, to be confronted with it. And to some extent, I understand that, because this is one of the most ugliest topics you can talk about, sexual abuse of minors. It's very uncomfortable for many people. But anyway, who else than Christians, who else than Catholics should and could approach also the sins and the crimes committed by our neighbors, by our faithful by our clergy, if not us, because we have received the gift of redemption. We have been offered the salvation, and we know by the catechism and by our own church teaching that there is a way to reach forgiveness. That is when one acknowledges sins, repents, confesses, and does reparation. This is what in the personal confession happens. And why is it so difficult to apply to the church as such? I mean, I really also from a spiritual and a faith point of view, I ask myself, where is the faith in that reality, in that process of reconciliation, which passes through all those stages, but then at the end, God offers us forgiveness if we repent, if we confess, and if we do reparation. So this is what has been very painful for me to see how many people in the church, and I don't talk about church leadership only, don't really undergo that process. What gives me hope is many people with whom I work, and first and foremost, I can call on survivors. We have just had a very intense meeting with survivors of clergy sexual abuse, and it is very challenging to sit down for, in our case, for 3 days and to listen to the stories and to listen to all the stories, not only of the abuse, but also of being confronted with the neglectfulness and the denial and the resistance and the attitude of church officials, and not only church officials, to just throw the door in the face of people who are asking for just being listened to. So when such a trust that you can sit down with people who have been harmed so grievously is established, and as short-lived such experiences may be, but this is so really, for me, this is so hopeful that we can be together, that we can sit in one room, that we can discuss what it means to really take responsibility on the church's side. That is one major aspect that is so impactful for me and so helpful also in the continuation of the journey. Secondly, the students we have, they are very committed people from dioceses, from religious congregations, from religious institutions worldwide who come to train with us. And we see the change of attitude. We see the change of mentality happening when they go back. Thirdly, I'm privileged to have encountered many people around the globe who are working for change in the church and in the society at large, that are really committed to safeguarding. And this is also, of course, something that helps me to continue the journey. As much as we have a very dedicated team here at the Institute of Anthropology at the Gregorian University, I personally, with the direct superiors with whom I had to deal with, I have always been supported. I felt always that support, and it was also expressed publicly. And I really hope that this can come to a tipping point where, as a church, we acknowledge what has happened in the past, we try to journey with victims and survivors, and we do our best to educate ourselves and others for the sake of safeguarding safe processes, safe relationships, and safe spaces. That is what safeguarding is all about.
Father Hans, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And thank you, too, for offering us words of hope at the end of what you quite rightly say is one of the darkest places in the experience of not only the church, but also humanity. And thank you for the hope that you embody for other victims and the journeying and the support you offer them at your own expense. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and we're very grateful to have had the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much.